Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, March 16th, 2015. Just a couple of days before tomorrow's Israeli elections, we're seeing the real Benjamin Netanyahu. You can't hide your lying eyes and your smile's in disguise. We're seeing the true colors of Benjamin Netanyahu. His leading opponent, Isaac Herzog of the Zionist Union, is now ahead of Netanyahu in the polls. And so, no stranger to pandering, Bibi visited Har Homa, a controversial Jerusalem neighborhood where construction on land that Israel captured back in 1967 has ignited international outrage for more than 15 years. And so he went to visit them, and he admitted that building settlements in Har Homa, quote, it was a way of stopping Bethlehem from moving toward Jerusalem. This neighborhood, exactly, because it stops the continuation of the Palestinians. I saw the potential was really great. And a spokesman for the PLO says he has confirmed verbally for the first time what we have denounced for years, that Har Homa is not about an innocent Jerusalem neighborhood on occupied land, but about splitting occupied East Jerusalem from Bethlehem. But by making his statement that if he is reelected, there will be no withdrawals from the West Bank and no concessions to the Palestinians, Netanyahu has exposed what we have seen through his actions for years. He is not interested in any peaceful negotiations. He is not interested in seeing a Palestinian state of any dimensions. And he's very comfortable whipping up fear among the voters in Israel in advance of the election. Quote, there is a real threat here that a left-wing government will join the international community and follow its orders. There's going to be an international initiative to take us back to the 1967 lines and divide Jerusalem. This is going to come, and we need to form a solid, strong national government headed by Likud in order to ward off these initiatives. So he is really doubling down and hoping that by appealing to the most extreme Zionist elements in Israel, that Netanyahu will be able to squeak out re-election. We shall see. Now, I must have missed a memo or an announcement in recent weeks that there was some sort of a merger between the American Republican Party and Israel's Likud Party. Because we heard the announcement over the weekend that a powerful Senate investigatory committee is planning to investigate alleged meddling in the Israeli election by groups funded by U.S. taxpayer dollars and by, in particular, Jeremy Byrd, who worked for Obama's campaigns in 08 and 2012. And this is just another distraction. But what really bothers me here is that the United States Senate is going to investigate actions in a foreign country? Now, if the Israelis want to investigate this, and if they come up with any solid evidence, I'll be happy to pay attention. But this is simply another political stunt that shows that the loyalties of our elected leaders, particularly Republicans, but not exclusively, are greater to the state of Israel than they are to their own United States of America. And this is so troubling. Because over the years, American political consultants have worked for members of all different flanks in Israeli politics. This is not new. And this allegation that State Department money was funneled into the One Voice movement, well, it deserves investigation. But I'm not persuaded that this is a significant issue. And the real foreign money that's flowing into the elections in Israel is coming from Americans like Sheldon Adelson, the casino mogul, who was there cheering Netanyahu on when he spoke to the joint session of Congress 2 weeks ago. Juan Cole at the University of Michigan nails it with the top five ways Netanyahu sabotaged U.S. and Israel interests. And he notes, on Sunday, in a rare public display of Netanyahu's unhinged paranoia, he opined that foreign governments were sending money into Israel to his rivals, conspiring with leftists to unseat him. Famously, Netanyahu's campaign is the one with the foreign money, that of Sheldon Adelson and other sketchy American billionaires. But whether he gets another term or not, Netanyahu will be remembered for the damage he did to U.S. interests and those of Israel itself. He scuttled the George Mitchell peace process, initiated by Obama in 2009. He scuttled the 2013 and 14 Kerry peace talks. And, of course, in each case, he greenlighted new settlement expansions, timed to rile the Palestinians and make it clear that Israel was never interested in bargaining. Item 3, when the peace talks predictably failed, Netanyahu launched a brutal assault on the Gaza Strip last summer, with indiscriminate fire killing nearly 2,000, mostly non-combatants, and wiping out every entire neighborhoods. Netanyahu involved himself in U.S. domestic politics, campaigning for Mitt Romney back in 2012. No Senate investigation of that. And finally, Netanyahu conspired with Boehner to undermine the president's negotiations with Iran by giving a speech to Congress only 2 weeks before his own election. This blatant interference in U.S. foreign policy is not unusual for other countries, but most of them aren't honorary members of the Republican Party, such that they can sabotage as insiders. Very well put, Professor Cole. And just to show you the lack of ethics that I see on the part of many of the extreme supporters of the State of Israel, I will bring you Exhibit A here, a full-page ad in Saturday's New York Times, extolling the corrupt senator from New Jersey, Robert Menendez, described as Iran's worst nightmare, Israel's great friend. And, of course, this doesn't mention that he's about to be indicted on charges of corruption for helping his buddy, the ophthalmologist in Florida. And the language here is so over-the-top ridiculous. Let me quote. We're inspired by Senator Menendez's audacity to speak truth to power, willing to reach across party lines on issues of conscience. He has stood up valiantly for the human rights of the people of Cuba. This is a way for Israelis to separate Democrats from Obama and interfere in American foreign policy. And he stood up for the American and Israeli people against the administration's rush to conclude a deal with Iran that would endanger the security of both nations. Watching Menendez defy those who would appease Iran is like watching an American lion, tall and proud, often alone and condemned, but never breaking, bowing, or bending. What bullshit. This reminds me of when, during the Watergate years, Nixon was on the ropes, and the Moonies came to his defense. All these Koreans talking about what a great American he was and how we should be ashamed that he was being vilified. Utterly ridiculous. All right, I have two more exhibits from the New York Times, and you can tell I'm a newspaper junkie. But a very bleak depiction of the scene in Syria after 4 full years of civil war. They use some aerial photos, satellite pictures taken at night. And it shows the darkness in Syria, where nearly 80% of the public streetlights or other lighting is just gone because of the civil war there. And that's tragic, and it's worth noting, and I think it's very important. But what was deeply ironic is that on the opposing page, as you look at the newspaper, is a full-page ad from Citibank patting itself on the back for providing funding to the city of Detroit, which, to my knowledge, has not been involved in a civil war, because over the years, the financial problems there and the decay of the urban center led to as much as 40% of the streetlights in Detroit not working. And I just present this for your own juxtaposition and process the irony here. That parts of Detroit are still black at night, total darkness. And we have a bank, and it's patting itself on the back here, and maybe they did a good thing here by providing money to the bankrupt city of Detroit to turn the lights back on. But it just shows the bankruptcy of the United States as we continue to throw more endless sums at open-ended foreign entanglements, and we ignore the crying needs of the people in our own midst, right here in Detroit City. Every day I like to pause and thank the people who support my work here at the PBC Podcast. Michael Powell just renewed his annual subscription, and so did David Radcliffe. I want to thank you both. And Jeff Lipinski, Deborah Kennedy, they're longtime monthly subscribers here. I'd like you to join them, and frankly, I need your help. Revenues have been declining in recent months because we've got more people ending subscriptions than starting them. So if you value the information and the opinion that you hear from me, well, I'd like you to return the favor. And I don't want to get desperate or escalate or start threatening or anything like that. I just try to be honest with you that I need your help. So come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click the sign-up link. It's right under my picture on the homepage. And that takes you to a page where you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month. Or our best deal, that $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers earn a bonus gift, a copy of the ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's Empire of Chaos. Well, over the weekend, John Kerry made news in several different ways. He's resumed the talks with the Iranians over its nuclear intentions, Iran's nuclear intentions. He was in Sharm el-Sheikh, the resort town on the Mediterranean, part of Egypt, where he was cheerleading this conference where different countries came and pledged to invest or give money to the corrupt dictatorship of al-Sisi and ignore the Arab Spring, ignore the Morsi government, ignore the coup that took it down. No, we don't even say coup. This Associated Press story refers to the military's 2013 ouster of the elected president. And on Facebook today, I don't have a way of playing it for you, but there's a funny clip of the State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki stating, and she knows she's lying, that we don't support military coups or coups of any kind. And yet, we allowed this to happen in Egypt with barely a peep. Ukraine, the list goes on and on and on. And so there's John Kerry, and just a few miles away in the Gaza Strip, there are people freezing and some of them suffering greatly. Because the promised investment following the attack by Israel last summer has not materialized. But who cares about the Palestinians? Egypt, that's a government we can get cozy with, because they suppress their people and they buy U.S. military supplies, and they will generally do our bidding when it's demanded of them. So he also tipped off, John Kerry did, that the U.S. about ready to restore full military aid to Egypt. And while he was speaking at the conference, to add dramatic effect, the Egyptian military buzzed with Apache helicopters, reminding Kerry of the importance that Egypt attaches to American military aid. We suspended about $700 million of the $1.3 billion annually given to Egypt, and the hints are there. That will be restored pretty soon. But that's not all. Our blowhard Secretary of State put that big old foot back in his mouth. And he said that he thinks that in the end we're going to have to negotiate to get Assad out of power in Syria. And everybody is rejecting his comment. So, Bashar al-Assad says, well, declarations from outside do not concern us. But he criticized Kerry for alienating U.S. allies, including France and Turkey, who insisted Assad could not be a part of any negotiated solution. Britain's position is similar, but they kept quiet. And, you know, on the one hand, I think Kerry is speaking to the obvious. But as a diplomat, he should freshen up on his scripts before he opens his mouth. Once again, the Obama administration has changed the exit plan from Afghanistan. More troops will stay longer and continue to fight in combat missions that are disguised as counterterrorism. And predictably, my voice will be the only one you hear objecting to another change in our plans to leave Afghanistan by this president. I hope other people pipe up, but I never hear it. Meanwhile, a front-page story on Sunday's New York Times exposed that in 2010, the Obama team agreed to tap into some funds and get a hostage released by paying $5 million to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda turned around and used the money to buy more weapons. And that's pretty embarrassing, and it just shows how ridiculous so much of our strategy is and how much money is being squandered. But buried in this article, what I find fascinating, it reads, the CIA, meanwhile, continues to drop off bags of cash at the presidential palace in Kabul every month. When Karzai was there, it was $1 million or more every month in cash. And once you give these guys cash, who knows what they'll do with it? The funny thing is that bin Laden was writing his buddies and saying, be careful with that cash. It could have radiation. It could have, GPS markers in there. Take it and exchange it into other currency. Don't keep that cash. Well, it turns out that we are still delivering bags of cash to the president's office in Kabul. It's not clear how robust the constraints on the cash are, but that's how we operate in that part of the world. And it pains me to say, here's how we operate in our part of the world. I have three stories for you related to the FBI and our government's political theater related to so-called domestic terrorism. Three Brooklyn men accused of plotting to join the Islamic State appeared in court on Friday. They entered not guilty pleas, being accused of providing material support to terrorists. And there's another case where there's a paid FBI informant. I have no confidence in the legitimacy of that investigation or the prosecution that will result from it. And I have two pieces of evidence to offer you. I link to both of them in the show file for this podcast, and I encourage you to read these articles in their entirety. First up, Trevor Aronson, who's been a guest on our program several times. He wrote the book called Terror Factory, where he examined the history of FBI domestic terror prosecution since 9/11. He appeared on our program last summer when he was working for Al Jazeera. And today, his work pops up at The Intercept, the Glenn Greenwald, Pierre Omidyar online outlet. And it's a powerful story, similar to the others. Here, the man in question is named Sami Asmakak. And the story opens with him recording his jihadi video before he gets ready to strap on a suicide vest and go do something with it. He was 25 years old when he filmed what the FBI and Department of Justice would later call a martyrdom video. He was also broke and struggling with mental illness. And after he recorded the video at a dumpy hotel in Tampa, he prepared to deliver what he thought was a car bomb to a popular Irish bar. According to the government, Asmakak was a dangerous lone wolf terrorist who would have bombed the place. But if he was a terrorist, he was only one in his troubled mind and in the minds of ambitious federal agents. The government couldn't provide any evidence that he had connections to international terrorists. He didn't have his own weapons. He didn't have enough money to replace the dead battery in his beat-up 94 Honda Accord. He was the target of an elaborately orchestrated FBI sting that involved a paid informant, as well as FBI agents and support staff working on the setup for more than 3 months. The FBI provided all the weapons seen in the martyrdom video. The Bureau gave him the car bomb he allegedly planned to detonate, and even money for a taxi so he could get to where the FBI needed him to go. He was a deeply disturbed young man, according to several psychiatrists and psychologists who examined him. He became a terrorist only after the FBI provided the means, opportunity, and final prodding necessary to make him one. And so, in this article, Trevor Aronson also summarizes what we have told you on this program many times. Informant-led sting operations are central to the FBI's counterterrorism program. Of 508 defendants prosecuted in federal terrorism cases since 9/11, 243 were involved with an FBI informant. 158 were the targets of sting operations. And in those cases, an informant or FBI undercover operative led 49 defendants in their terrorism plots, similar to this one. And so this pattern continues. And what Trevor Aronson also was able to discover through a court case is records of the FBI guys working behind the scenes. And think of the control room like the one in the Hunger Games, all right? But the FBI doesn't have virtual control. You know, they can't make a river stop or flood or, you know, those kinds of things in the Hollywood movie. But they had a control room, a command post set up. And the conversations of the guys behind the scenes were recorded and transcribed. One FBI squad supervisor describes Osmakok, I guess that's how it said, as a retarded fool who doesn't have a pot to piss in. The agents talk about the eagerness for a Hollywood ending for their sting. They refer to the targets as wishy-washy, his terrorist ambitions as a pipe dream scenario. The transcripts show FBI agents struggled to put $500 in his hands so he could make a down payment on the weapons. So they gave him the money to give them so they could set him up. I mean, this is just so incredible. And while this gets published, you know, that's on The Intercept. My next story here is from The Guardian. These are one-day stories. Nobody asked James Comey, the FBI director, why this shit continues to go on. And keep in mind, the story I just told you and the one I'm about to relate to you both have occurred under the Obama administration. The Change in Hope guy. So, my last story here today is an excellent piece published in The Guardian. Credit to Chris McGreal, the reporter who wrote this, and we learn about a man named Yonas Fikri, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. He was born in Eritrea, but he's an American citizen who lived in Portland, and in February, he was returned to Portland on a luxury private jet paid for by the government of Sweden. They brought him home because the FBI put him on a no-fly list because he refused to become a paid FBI informant and snitch on his fellow Muslims at the largest mosque in the Portland area. Over a five-year period, the FBI had him arrested, interrogated, tortured for 106 days in the United Arab Emirates. And they flatly admitted to him that this would stop and they'd take him off the no-fly list if he became an FBI informant. Now, this is well outside the bounds of the law, of anything that relates to due process, or anything that's even contemplated by the Draconian Patriot Act. The FBI uses its power to put people on the no-fly list to coerce them into doing things that are illegal that they don't want to do. And so, in 2010, Fikri went to Khartoum in Sudan. He went to the U.S. Embassy to get advice from the commercial section. Then he was invited back. He was told it would be a briefing for U.S. citizens on the security situation. Instead, he was in a small room with two men who identified themselves as FBI agents from Portland. They asked him a few questions. He said, "I want a lawyer." very quickly became clear they wanted information about his mosque, which is called Masjid az-Sabr. Other members of that mosque, 9 of them have been put on the no-fly list. 6 of them have been sentenced to prison. And so Fikri hesitated to answer the agent's questions. I asked them, why am I on a no-fly list after I leave the country? I said, you did this in order to coerce me to work with you guys. They said there's a case in Portland. They want me to help them. I asked, what is this case about? They say, we can't talk about it. You have to agree you'll work with us, and if you agree, we'll tell you. And so his nightmare continues. He went to Sweden for a while. And then he went to the United Arab Emirates. And that's where he was taken into custody again. Months of interrogation. I refused to answer questions. That's when the beating started. They started with punches, slaps. They got tired of that, so they brought water hoses. There's the hard ones, the black ones, and there's the soft ones. The soft kind they use for strangling. When I refused to answer, they put that thing on my neck. They had me lay down and beat me on the soles of my feet. So then he had a bizarre meeting at the U.S. Embassy, which he found out is just a few blocks away from where he was being held and tortured. And he's visited by a woman who gives only the name Marwa. And he didn't tell her he had been tortured because the torturers told him not to tell him. Or he would be held longer. So after 106 days of imprisonment, the United Arab Emirates released him without charge. So then he went to Sweden, where he applied for political asylum in January but was denied because he couldn't prove that he had been tortured, even though the Swedish authorities apparently believed him. And so finally, in February, he was notified by the U.S. government that he was on the no-fly list because, quote, he may be a threat to civil aviation or national security. And facing that, the government of Sweden paid $200,000 to charter a luxury jet, a Gulfstream or something like that, and return this man to the United States. Because his own government would not permit that, not because he was any threat, but because he refused to submit to the intimidation and become a snitch. That's what our nation has become. A nation of snitches. And frankly, I'm disgusted. And I'm still Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you. Until we meet again, happy trails to you. Keep smiling.